educating the client is a huge part of our job, making sure they understand that this is vital, that this could have legal ramifications. It's completely unethical, in my opinion, to not inform the client of these issues.
From Bright Umbrella, this is Control ClickCast. We inspect the web for you. Today, we have Kristen Valentine on the show to discuss ethics and technology. I'm your host, Leah Alcantara, and I'm joined by my fab co-host,
Emily Lewis.
Craft CMS is excited to announce the inaugural .all conference for craft developers. .all 2017 is taking place on October 22nd and 23rd in Portland, Oregon, and will feature a Craft 3 workshop led by Ryan Ireland of Vijingo, a plugin development lab, and a full day of sessions relevant to craft and web development. For more information and to buy your ticket, visit .all.com. That's .all.com. Hope to see you there.
Kristen had every intention of becoming a famous oboist, but instead she went into technology, both as an interactive designer and web developer. She has championed accessibility, thoughtful systems, implementation, and user-centric interfaces. And today she's here to talk with us about technology and ethics. Welcome to the show, Kristen.
Thanks for having me.
So Kristen, can you tell our listeners a bit more about yourself?
Sure. I've been a web developer for about 12 years. Professionally, anyway, I was messing around in GeoCities and Angel Fire long before that, of course. But yeah, when I'm not doing that, I'm usually try to spend as much time outside as possible. So I do a lot of mountain biking, road biking, hiking, all that good stuff.
And you're in the Pacific Northwest, so it's kind of like perfect area to do that kind of stuff, right?
Yeah. I'm in Portland, so it's really easy to get outside, that's for sure. Pretty much everyone who moves here ends up becoming an outdoor person.
Yeah, it sounds a lot like Seattle, too.
Yeah. I grew up in Spokane, so it's not exactly far from me.
So, Kristen, before we dive into how ethics and technology intersect, can you define ethics? What are they?
Yeah, it's kind of a hard thing to define in some ways, but generally speaking, it's sort of generally agreed upon principles of conduct for people. So there's lots of different ideas around what that might mean. So in terms of, it's kind of like longstanding ideas of right and wrong, like right to life, right to privacy, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. And there's also the idea of like theoretical versus applied ethics. So theoretical ethics is kind of more about understanding the nature of ethics and sort of that philosophical reasoning, whereas applied ethics is like, you know, in situation X, what would I do? Mm-hmm. So that's kind of more along the lines of like professional ethics is part of that applied. So in terms of thinking, sort of like the obvious things I tend to think of are like lawyers have very specific professional ethics they have to abide or they'll lose their license.
Same with like doctors too, you know, people who have these critical professional roles. But it's been a super, super long time since I was in college, but yeah. I had to take an introduction to ethics class for my degree, and it was more theoretical than practical and sort of how ethics have evolved in different lines of thinking. The most interesting lesson that I walked away from that class was, I'm not sure it was the best lesson for, you know, 19-year-old me, but we had to do a group project. And when we presented the project in front of the class, the professor then asked each of us if we wanted to be graded as an individual or as a group after we had given the presentation. And I had worked with a group that was just like not doing a whole lot of work. But I went with what I felt was like the socially acceptable choice to say, well, I want to be judged as a group. And so he gave us a B and then informed me that if I had chosen individual, I would have gotten an A in front of the whole class. So like that was his lesson in theoretical ethics. Look out for number one.
Well, it's just interesting that you bring that up because before this show, you sent Kristen and I this link about trust. Mm-hmm. And it was actually a game simulation about, you know, trust exercises and what would you do in situation A, B, or C. And a lot of it was,
look after number one or look after the overall group or a variation of those. Mm-hmm. And so it's interesting that your ethics professor basically did that in a live real world simulation. Mm-hmm.
Well, I had shared you that game. It's called The Evolution of Trust. It's like an online game. It works great on mobile, or at least it did on my Android, and works nicely on the desktop. You know what? I played it the first time with the assumption of choosing the lookout for number one each time. And that really only works in certain situations in terms of like everyone doing well, which frankly is kind of, I think, the premise of the game is trying to promote, like, if everyone can do well and how you achieve that. And I think the lesson that my professor was trying to teach was, at the age I was, with the experience in life that I had at the time, I was pretty upset because I felt like I had missed out on something. But looking back, I learned a lot working in that group. So maybe I got a B, but I got some other things that maybe couldn't have been measured. And can sort of see that perspective as well.
Well, I find that an interesting conclusion, because I thought that, for me, the perspective of the game was, overall, depending on the length of time and the length of interactions, choosing the group is actually beneficial. Like, as in, well, really, I don't know. Was the real lesson actually finding win-win for everyone, right?
That's the win-win
for everyone. But then if that's the perspective, isn't that a group perspective instead of individual?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's kind of comes down to what Kristen was defining earlier, like what people's ideas of what the right and wrong way of doing things are. And I think it's kind of easy to point to lawyers and doctors because that stuff's codified, right? Like you said, they could lose their license if they don't follow these rules. But then it becomes nebulous when you're talking about industries that don't have this defined, like ours, or like some areas of tech.
And it's harder still when so many of us didn't go to school for this, you know?
Yes,
right.
You know, when I went to school, there was no such thing as web design class. There was no such thing as web development class. And even CS wasn't necessarily the same thing. So many of us are self-taught. And even the people that go and do, you know, six-month code boot camps, you know, I'm seriously doubting they're taking some kind of ethics class.
Yeah.
So in regards to that, you know, we've mentioned other industries and we've already pointed out that our sector technically doesn't have those structured learning for ethics. How do you believe ethics plays into our technology sector overall?
Yeah, that's a really great question. I mean, I think in the past, it hasn't really. You know, I think that it's a tricky thing, right? Because I think in some ways, technology separates humanity from animals, you know, like from the beginning, mm-hmm. we've created technology in the forms of, you know, whether it's a rock to hit, you know, with or a wheel. And obviously, so much more than that, but it does set us apart. And so I think that we get stuck in this mindset that progress means everything. It's like we have to mm-hmm. keep pushing ahead. And anyone who disagrees with this notion of technological process is, you know, a crankpot or Luddite. I mean, looking even back at the Industrial Revolution, you know, people started to say, hey, this is changing our lives in a way that is unhealthy. And those mm-hmm. people were just swiftly ignored. And you start looking at things like, I think really when, you know, we invented the atomic bomb was when people really started to say, hey, is this progress? Like, is this what we want? Mm-hmm. And those questions have been around for a long time. Like, you know, and we're starting to get into like gene editing, artificial intelligence, self-driving cars. I think it's really starting to come to a point where people are questioning, do we just blindly continue on with this quote unquote progress? Or is this something that we as a society need to take a step back and look at, which is mm-hmm. very difficult to do because we're not really set up to do that, I think, in a successful way.
Yeah, I think because, as you were describing, there's such this push for innovation and technology, there lacks the pull of reflection and analysis of, I guess, the human component. I mean, maybe we analyze the data, but maybe we don't really analyze the people and even effects over time.
Yeah, I think what we tend to look at is we get really excited, right? Every new thing is going to change the way we live. You know, like the computer revolution was supposed to like free us from the binds of, like, you know, the internet was supposed to level the playing field. That's what was the promise, right? It was supposed to bring up the poor and make everyone have a chance. But you could argue in some ways it has, but if anything, we're becoming more and more polarized.
I find it interesting how you even brought up all the way back, we're talking about current technology, but with the Industrial Revolution, I think the computer revolution, the information revolution has a great parallel in that, oh, wow, we can have factories and we can have energy and we can just throw as many people into this problem and get things done. But at the time when it first started blowing up, there was no regulations with like pollution and working conditions and all those things. So like people were getting, you know, overworked and sick. And then on top of that, too, increasing disparity between economic opportunity, like the factory workers versus the factory owner kind of situation. And it feels like to me, like when I'm thinking about it, that's very similar to even what's happening with the technological revolution, where we're like, oh, innovate, innovate, innovate. And objectively, if you're a robot and you look at it, you're like, yay, progress, quote unquote, like stuff is getting done, things are being made. But at what cost?
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yeah, I feel like as we're talking, just so many examples pop into my head of where we can see ethics at play in technology right now. I forget which guest it was, Leah. I feel like it was either Noah or Ben on that episode we did a while back on shipping and fulfillment.
Okay,
but
yeah.
We were talking about, you know, how everyone's gotten so used to how inexpensive it is to ship things through something like Amazon and get it quickly, right, that we've, in essence, perhaps perverted the sense of what the value is and what it takes to actually ship. And this has repercussions on other shipping institutions and not institutions, companies and employees and workers, or like Uber and the reality of the people running the company versus the drivers versus the impact on the local community and cab drivers. Like these are all real technological innovations that have very equally real ethical implications.
I feel like one issue with that is sort of that startup culture that we have where it's just innovate, innovate, innovate. The other problem with that too is that our government wants, you know, they want to create jobs. They want to create economic opportunity. And they see that tech is such a huge and growing industry. So they want to attract that kind of innovation. They want to attract those kind of software companies. But the problem is there's very little reflection on how those innovations might impact the communities that they're a part of.
Yeah, that reminds me of our latest episode on mobile tech for global change. And our guest, Rowena Luke, basically mentioned that technology is an amplifier of human intention.
Definitely.
And that what's interesting, and we discussed this in the episode several times about how one of the issues when you're deploying or creating apps for, you know, underserved communities, global communities, places in Africa, et cetera, a problem happens where it's like people are making tech for tech's sake and not actually thinking about the audience, you know, involved. And so it's like, yes, let's push to innovate, but what are you actually innovating on?
Or right. For.
Mm-hmm. For, yeah.
So we've been talking about tech. Let's get a little narrower and talk about our field, our web design and development. Where does ethics come into that sort of role as a designer or as a developer? Are there challenges that you see in today's news or whatever that you think are demonstrations of like the challenges that we face as web workers and ethics?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I think one thing, you know, when I was younger, when I tended to think about ethics and what I was doing, I would tend to think like, well, you know, I wouldn't ever work on a cigarette ad, or I would never build a porn site. And that was really as far as my thinking got on the matter. But that's not really, you know, that's fine and well for your personal standards, but that's not really like a general professional standard. And like, how could I bring ethics into everything that I did? And I think it's a little tough because it's easy to feel like you don't have a choice or you can't make decisions. But, you know, specifically as a designer, clients hire you to make decisions, to consult mm-hmm. on things, and to help them understand why doing this or that has ethical implications. So I do think there's a lot there. And actually, Mike Montero wrote a great article on Dear Design Student about this, that we all have choices and we have to day to day, like, how can we make the world better? How can we, you know, it's not just about working on nonprofit websites or with nonprofit organizations. It's about how can we create ethical work day to day. And I think part of the problem is that even the organizations and associations that we currently have, like the AIGA, their ethical standards on things are more related to the client relationship. So, mm-hmm. you know, keeping mm-hmm. confidentiality and that kind of stuff, which is great. I mean, that's certainly part of it. But I guess I'm kind of wondering, you know, where are the information about making sure that we're not deceiving people, that we're not tricking, you know, like there's so many things in there. As far as development goes, there are some software engineering best practices and organizations that have ethical guidelines that I think is a little bit less related to web development specifically. Mm-hmm. But they do a pretty good job of kind of talking about privacy being a huge one, generally trying to create software that improves, you know, improves the world. But given the lack of formal education most of us have, you know, in this industry, I doubt many people have read that or know much about it. And I think, unlike lawyers and doctors, you know, there's no bite there. There's no, like, stick.
Right, right.
So, you know, if you deliver software that's not bug-free, you know, you're not going to get your license taken away. So they're guidelines, but they're not very sticky.
Although, like, it is leaning a little bit more when we're talking about accessibility.
Yeah.
And in terms of the stickiness of that, because I believe in 2018, the federal government is actually going to start.
U.S.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the U.S. government is going to start being a lot more strict about the accessibility of federal websites,
yeah.
federally funded websites, in order to be more accessible.
Yeah, I mean, that's such a huge issue for me. And I think that is one of the big ethical standards that I think everyone should have. I mean, there is a huge stick there. I mean, many huge companies have been sued for not having their sites fully accessible.
Yeah. And I think, and just to add a little bit to what Leah was saying, it's not just websites, it's also internal applications. Mm-hmm. And my boyfriend Jason's actually working on a project right now involving that sort of huge scope of all of the legacy applications and use of Excel files and PDFs and all that other stuff to sort of bring these government agencies and tools they use up to these accessibility standards. And I couldn't agree with you more, Chris. And I feel like that's fundamental to, I mean, I can only speak to myself as a front-end developer, but I feel like that's fundamental to what I do. And yes. I feel like it's an expensive, incredibly time-consuming and resource-intensive effort to retrofit or mediate the stuff that has been not built right from the start.
Yeah, and there's an added problem of, you know, for a lot of people, web development is a black box. They the developers go away, they come back and something's been made, and they don't really know anything about the details about accessibility. That's something they even have to think about. You know, and educating the client is a huge part of our job, making sure they understand that this is vital, that this could have legal ramifications. It's completely unethical, in my opinion, to not inform the client of these issues.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what's interesting too is that the internet or internet access is considered now a basic human right. Mm. And like other basic human rights, there should be standards involved in actually applying that and making sure that this human right is not abused.
Or denied.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, in terms of accessibility, there are standards that we can all apply our websites to and apps. So,
and that's why that sort of the stick of legal implications is a useful one when you're trying to talk to your clients. They may not appreciate the ethical obligation of making their site or tools or whatever accessible to everyone, but they probably will appreciate the legal implications.
Well, yeah. There's also the business implications in that. Don't you want to address 20% more of your audience? Don't you want 25% increase in customers and users.
Yeah, it's true. But then you have the challenge of, let's just say, marketing has decided they want one thing because it converts. You can point out all the examples of how it's not accessible and could be excluding a portion of their audience, but that is their opinion. And you know what I mean? So it sort of becomes a big challenge.
Yeah, it's always tricky.
Yeah, it really is. But Kristen's right. It's our obligation to have that conversation. Let's talk a little bit on ethics, like people being unethical. So you had written an article about ethics and technology, and you included an example, a practical situation of design. It was a bridge in Long Island that was intentionally built to keep people out. So it was intentionally unethical. Have you come across other similar intentional examples in tech or the web?
Yeah, you know, I think some of these things, intentional versus unintentional, is like kind of a hard thing to define sometimes, because a lot of it is lack of education, although I don't think that's a pass. But yes, I mean, I think anytime design is used to deceive people, which it often is, I mean, you think about those like pop-ups that come up that try to get you to sign up for newsletters and stuff. Right. When they have that huge button like sign up, and then underneath it, really tall, really tiny, and you can barely see it, says like, no, I don't want your newsletter. I'm a horrible person.
Or, yeah, yes,
I
yeah.
hate animals. No, I don't want your newsletter.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I mean, for me, it's, I have to hunt for that tiny little link that says, no, I don't want the thing. Mm-hmm. You know, imagine someone with poor vision or someone with a cognitive issue where they think, but I like animals.
Right.
For you and me, it's probably easy to roll our eyes and close it. But that's not true for everybody. Mm-hmm. And I think that is incredibly unethical and extremely intentional.
Mm-hmm. I agree. Gosh, some of this stuff makes me upset because you see things improving, but at the same time, they're not. So as things improve, there are still new issues that are popping up or that aren't being addressed.
Yeah. And I think, too, like, I guess a big news article recently, how biased many algorithms can be, you know, about showing people this or that. That's pretty intentional. You know, they create those algorithms with a very specific intention. You know, they may claim that that's not really what they're trying to do, but you know, what they're trying to do is make money regardless of how it affects people. So I would say, yeah, that's pretty intentional. Mm-hmm. And along those lines, selling users information, you know, hiding those privacy settings so that people don't realize that they're being sold to advertisers. You know, that's starting to get better because people are kind of waking up to these issues, but it's definitely still happening.
And I mean, even something that, you know, of course, is like a big topic right now, but, you know, the dissemination of false information and packaging it in a way that is really intended to deceive people about the legitimacy of the news source.
Yeah.
Yep.
So I think some of those are really clearly intentional. What are unintentional things that you see that designers and devs that are tuning in and want to improve how they approach their profession that they could be on the lookout for and try and start avoiding?
Yeah, I think one thing is making sure you're focusing on the people and not on the tech, as you kind of mentioned earlier, which is kind of a broad thing to say, but I do think that that gives you a sense of whether or not what you're creating, how it might affect people, puts you in that mindset. But, you know, like we were talking about earlier, I think accessibility is one of those things that if a team is not educated on accessibility, they just might not even be thinking about it. Mm-hmm. I don't think that's a pass, but I think that's can be unintentional. Mm-hmm. I think also, you know, one thing we haven't really touched on is security, making sure that the things that we create are secure, that they won't leak credit card information or other sensitive data. And so an unintentional thing can be people not setting their sites up to be secure, you know, allowing so many WordPress sites get hacked. And I think that's an unintentional thing, that WordPress is supposed to be so easy to set up. Anyone can 5-minute install, but you know, I think people don't realize they have to keep their software up to date and take basic secure standards to make sure that those things don't happen. But unfortunately, they do. And I don't think that's really intentional. But given that the tools we use are becoming easier for everyone to use, which is great, things like security can kind of, they're just not thinking about that. They don't have the education and knowledge in those situations.
Mm-hmm. Could you talk a little bit more about keeping the user, the human, the person in mind? We had Beth Dean on the show. Leia, was it last year or earlier this year?
It was last year.
To sort of talk about emotional intelligence in design. I feel like that is kind of like the sort of empathy in design theme that we are seeing a lot more in our industry. Is that kind of what you're talking about?
Yeah, for sure. Shout out to Beth. Ooh. Yeah, she's done a lot of work in this area, which is awesome. I mean, I think when you really focus on, you know, how does this affect people? Sort of one example that I can think of is Erica Meyer brought to the forefront a little while ago about when Facebook had those year in review things that they showed him his daughter who had recently died, which was horribly traumatic for him. And you have to imagine when the designers created that, they were only thinking about positive things. You know, they didn't think through, you know, there are how many millions and billions of people using this? Like, not everyone had a great year. Mm-hmm. Like, how can we really, that's kind of the point of UX research, right? Design research is talking to people, understanding all the different situations, which, you know, obviously for Facebook being used by so many people, they must have to do so much research. But, you know, taking a step back and really asking, you know, how is this going to be used by people? How does this solve their problems? What are the things that we're not thinking about? You know, I'm not, you know, I haven't had a recent death in my family, so it's just not something that's top of mind. Mm-hmm. But you really have to sit back and think about those things. And I really think that that's where UX can come into play a lot, because I think that's, you know, that's kind of their job. That's kind of...
They're already asking those questions.
Yeah, exactly.
Because of the nature of the work.
Yeah, and I have to think that can kind of create that, I guess, foil to the tech side. I was visiting my brother last weekend, and he is a biomedical researcher. And we kind of got into this topic a little bit. And it was interesting to hear him talk about how ethics are applied in medical research. Because to them, privacy is number one, like the privacy of the human subjects that are going through these randomized control trials, right? And so anyone who comes into contact in any way with anything has to take an ethics class. Mm. And then they have these review boards. So he's at a university, and so anytime, you know, there's a question, they go in front of a review board that has somebody from the community on it. And this is someone who's completely unrelated to the field whatsoever. Just a community member who has an interest in the subject, which is an interesting thing because they don't really have a stake in the game other than making sure that the community is thought of. And then obviously, you know, if one person does something that's unethical, they'll get fired. There's ramifications. And if the university as a whole is doing something unethical, they'll lose their funding. Mm-hmm. So there's just all these checks and balances that start to come into play. But they have these foils. They have these people that are making sure that what they're doing is ethical. In terms of animal research, they have veterinarians that take care of the animals. Mm-hmm. And they would like nothing more than to tell on the researchers, say, like, this researcher isn't doing something that's ethical. Like, that's their job, to be empowered to point out the unethical behavior of the researcher. And so when I think about technology, I'm like, who's the foil? Like, who is empowered?
Who's the checks and balance? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and it's not even just that they're the designer and they should, like, have empathy, but what they really need is to be empowered to turn around and say, hey guys, like, you know, what we're doing is really cool and innovative, but it has these side effects that we're just not really considering. And I think that it's hard because they're still in the company, right? Mm-hmm. You know, it'd be easy for other people in that company to turn around and be like, oh, well, yeah, but... So it's like, how do we empower those people to speak up, mm-hmm. you know? I don't know. And that's a huge challenge.
I find it so fascinating, like, when you mentioned how everyone is so concerned and serious about privacy in, you know, medicine. And for us as discussing this and even to layman people, it's like, yeah, of course, like, medical information is really private. However, all these web apps that mm-hmm. we're using have probably close to similar amount of information on us, and including medical information. It's to me, like, you know, I have my own level of privacy comfort or whatever, how much I'm willing to share. But there are people who share their medical information as well as, of course, all their addresses and phone numbers and everything to all these particular web apps. And, you know, I use Mint, for example, and I have my banks are attached to that information. And now you're making me wonder, holy crap, all these people who's actually working on my info probably should take an ethics class.
Yeah, it's kind of scary to think about. I mean, in terms of like security and privacy, you know, there are some companies, you know, typically like, I'm not going to deal with credit cards. Like, I'm going to go find someone like Stripe where it's all going to live on their servers and I know that I don't have to deal with it. But like, in terms of someone's address, you know, like, there's no standards about the security of the database that those addresses would live in.
Yeah, you know, I think it's a really frustrating, but I think it's an important conversation to have. I was also just thinking how challenging it is for just the three of us to sort of discuss this in a really hopeful, optimistic, oh, this is what we do way, because it's not clear right now. But I think this is when we start getting into an even bigger challenge when it goes outside of tech professionals speaking amongst themselves, but talking to the broader public about technical issues that affect them, their privacy, them caring about that the ISPs can now track our data and sell it based on our browsing behavior. So just, it's the concepts are so difficult for us to talk about. How do you inform the broader public so that they also vote and advocate for their interests where tech is involved?
Yeah, in many ways, I think that the public has to be the foil to the companies, right? Like we have to discuss these issues. I mean, I think people are starting to understand, but what's interesting about that is that the people who control that flow of information are the tech companies. So that's kind of disturbing when you think about it. But I think, unfortunately, it seems at this point that we have, as the consumers of these products, have to say, you know, if this isn't up to my standards of comfort level with privacy, I'm not going to use it. But, you know, how do you evaluate that? I don't have an answer for you. It's really, really hard.
As we mentioned, there's really no formal guidelines for ethics on the web for people who build the web. If you could create a standard, what would be the basics? What would it include?
I think some of the things that we talked about, like making sure what we create is accessible, I think is pretty basic. I think privacy concerns. I mean, the EU is definitely leading on this, like creating legal standards around privacy, around cookies and gathering information, and that whole right to be forgotten idea. So that is something that's happening, not in the US, of course, but and then as well as paramount security. In some ways, the companies are starting to push this, like Google's starting to prioritize sites that use HTTPS. But, you know, I think it also comes down to confidentiality, honesty. You know, a big one is really just being transparent with your users about how they're using, you're using their data. If there could be some way that we could rate or let people know, like, how does my data live here? How can I get it out? Like, what happens when the company shuts down? Does all my data get sold to somebody? Like, I feel like a lot of it comes down to transparency and understanding, and also just understanding why it's important. But yeah, I don't know that I have like specific bullet points of exactly what I would include, but those are sort of the topics I think are stand out to me.
I mean, it feels like not impossible, just it's an incredibly overwhelming challenge if you just think about the web standards movement. And how, I mean, I don't even hear people talking about quote unquote web standards anymore because people are calling it, you know, different things, accessibility, progressive enhancement, whatever. But I think one of the things I liked about that notion is that in a way, especially as a new developer who needs constraints, it was kind of my rule book. These are my rules. These are my standards. Therefore, these are the things I'm going to hold myself accountable for. And I think that's useful. And I wonder how much that kind of approach is being introduced, like I said, especially to new developers who do need something to measure themselves against.
Yeah, I think having the accessibility standards are helpful, but, you know, there's so many other things to think about. It would be nice to have something more tangible.
Well, what I liked was this article that Emily shared to me called Design Ethics in Practice. And she had very specific questions that should be asked throughout the project that I thought like were very straightforward and very clear. We're going to link to this article in the show notes, but she breaks them up into three particular phases, like questions you ask before your research and when you're starting to prepare to design, questions while you're defining the problem during your research, and of course, questions after the research or after you've already started to design. And just a couple of ones of my favorites. Of course, we've been kind of emphasizing this, but I like the specificity of some of these questions. Like, what are your assumptions about who will use this product? And then when you close your eyes and think of the personas you're making, are you thinking of stock photos of smiling white people in large offices and houses? You know, like, who are you not? You know, who are you not thinking about? And even the actual test itself, like the question, how accessible is the building where you'll be talking to users? So when you're actually doing the test, does the environment affect how the outcome is going to be, even if it's for a technological solution? So I just found that like really, really interesting. I think one way we could help with like formal guidelines is to have these generalized questions like codified somehow. Almost like the accessibility checklist or web standards checklist when you're going through these design processes.
A designing for humans checklist.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Beyond the fact that where it's like, is the contrast great, which is good for accessibility in terms of just visual design answer. Perhaps the real basis of all that is context. Like, what is the point of all of this? And who's going to be using it? Like, again, like you mentioned, Kristen, earlier, like getting people back into the focus of the app or the website in the first place.
Yeah. And I think one thing that continues to be tricky there is what are the unintended side effects of the thing that we create?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like for your average site, like that maybe isn't a big deal. But when we're talking about something like inventing the iPhone, you know, like
right.
We start thinking through how the huge society changes that have come from that, you know, like,
right.
I mean, how could you possibly know? But when you start thinking about how much like notifications has changed the way, you know, that you get like phantom buzzing in your pocket.
Right.
It's like a psychological changes in people. I mean, it's overwhelming to even begin to think about, but I think we should start thinking about these things.
Even if nothing changes, ultimately, I agree. We do have to think about these things because this is how, I don't know, not only people want to innovate, but don't we also want to create things that are long lasting? And the long lasting things are the things that help people, that really support a person's quality of life.
Yeah.
So Leah mentioned the Design Ethics in Practice article that has some of those specific questions you could ask yourself. Kristen, earlier you mentioned Mike Montero's Designer Code of Ethics. Do you have any other resources that you think could help someone or even an organization or team establish ethical guidelines at their work?
I think probably the best might be looking at other industries and see how they set up their ethical guidelines, because our industry is relatively new and that's why we don't have a code of ethics. I mean, if you think about it, how software engineering generally has been around a lot longer than just web work, but, you know, taking a look and see like, what does it mean for a lawyer to be ethical? What does it mean for, and perhaps a better example for us might be, what does it mean for an architect to be ethical? Or what does it mean for like a general contractor?
A mechanic.
Do they have a code of ethics? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think those might be a little bit closer to the stuff that we work on, but certainly, you know, an architect has accessibility standards that they have to abide by, you know. How does space affect the people inside of it? I think that's something that I think would be helpful for us as people who also create spaces that people gather.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's a really great statement, even with architecture, especially because of mobile devices, right? We're creating websites and apps, but they're interacting with it in a physical space, in physical areas, and whatever we're creating might not even end up in that mobile device. It could be in different types of spaces as well. So that could be a really good standard to start looking at.
You know, Leah, that just gets me thinking about the technology that's still just so, so innovative right now that it's really hasn't hit mainstream or even just the geeks. But the technology that we don't even know yet, where it's even more human than before, you know, wearable technology, technology right. in your physical space where it's not tied to any kind of device or,
right.
you know, people getting chipped. I was reading some article about that last week, you know, people getting microchips. What are the ethical implications of that? So I think it's important that we start having these discussions on a more regular, serious basis, because this is going to balloon as a challenge.
Yeah, and I think there are many other people, Anil Dash being one of them, that are having these conversations publicly. And I think that actually another great resource for people generally interested in this topic is there's a great podcast called Note to Self that talks a lot about, they have like a privacy game, I want to say, but they do a lot of great work just to, sort of about how tech influences us as people in society. It's a pretty great one.
Before we wrap up, Kristen, I'm just curious. So I think this has been a really fascinating talk, but I have to say, I don't feel super hopeful. So I'm just wondering if this is something that, you know, you think about a lot, you've written about on your company's blog, you know, what do you think about to focus on the opportunity, the hopefulness of how this could get better?
I think just the fact that people are becoming more tech savvy and having these conversations is making me hopeful. You know, Facebook has changed a lot based on people starting to realize how much it's like controlling their lives. It's controlling the media that we consume. I think people are starting to finally wake up to that. And what I really want is for our government also to wake up to that. I think, unfortunately, it seems like a lot of people in government tend to bury their heads when it comes to technology. And they often say like, oh, I don't even use the internet. I don't even know. It's like, this has huge implications for us as a democracy, as a society. Like, we all have to wake up here. You know, I don't know where, you know, laws and regulations need to come in here, but they certainly do. And especially once we start talking about net neutrality, which I think is a huge, obviously a huge issue for everybody on the web. But I think that the fact that as people become more and more tech savvy, that they're going to start waking up to some of these issues. But, you know, at the same time, I think as people get used to things, they become blinded by them. I think a really great quote from Langdon Winner in Do Artifacts of Politics, which is a great essay. He wrote, "In our times, people are often willing to make drastic changes in the way they live to accord with technological innovation. At the same time, they would resist similar kinds of changes justified on political grounds."
Yep. I'd even say social grounds, too.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's the scary part. You know, I think when technology is kind of released into the wild, people get used to it and they're unwilling to let it go. They're unwilling to see how it's changing their lives because you kind of become used to it. You become blind to it. And that's a huge challenge. And I'm sorry, you asked for something optimistic and I'm telling you something super pessimistic. But, you know, I do think people are starting to kind of see how these devices, how websites, how everything is affecting them and affecting their lives. And I hope that that starts to bring forth bigger conversations. And I think it is.
Well, and we're having this conversation and we're sharing the resources that we've found. So that to me is hopeful in that these things are being, you know, carefully considered. And it's just kind of the arc of time. Eventually, like we, again, you mentioned, Kristen, earlier, the web is young. This industry is young. Sometimes it takes a certain amount of time for people to codify these particular standards. Because even though we mentioned architects and doctors and lawyers, that took time for them to decide what makes sense. Or even like, so let's even be more broad. There's the Constitution and how many amendments are there, right? So at one point, somebody wrote a list of rules, and then as society changes and people change and lives change, then you make changes to that as well, right? Mm-hmm. And society has advanced because of that. And I think we're just at the beginning stages of that for the web. And since other things have changed and improved, I don't see why the web can be any different from that. Right.
And you think too, like even doctors are having to change, you know, as we start getting into technology around gene editing or all these other things that are going to start to become huge issues in the medical community. So it's going to be an ever changing conversation for sure.
Excellent, excellent conversation, in my opinion.
Yeah. I mean, this is one of those things where I really do feel like more and more our peers should be having this amongst ourselves and to the public and, you know, everyone else, because it's a complicated problem to tackle. But without discussing it, then nobody's tackling it, right?
Well, and it's worth tackling, I think, to your point, Leia, about us being young and that it takes time. You know, it is going to take time for everyone to see the win-win. You know, for everyone to say, okay, I'll build this site accessibly, and I can only envision that benefiting this group of people. Someday that person will see, oh, it benefits everyone and me. So I think it just takes time to start seeing where the win-win is.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's all the time we have for today. But before we finish up, we've got our rapid fire 10 questions so our listeners can get to know you a bit better.
Okay.
Are you ready?
Yep.
Okay. First question, introvert or extrovert?
Extroverted introvert.
The power is going to be out for the next week. What food from the fridge do you eat first?
Currently, there's nothing in the fridge. No condiments.
Ketchup.
Yeah.
What's your favorite website for fun?
Oh, gosh. My feed reader, probably. Nice. Mm-hmm.
What's the last thing you read?
Well, actually, I was reading Langdon Winner's The Whale and the Reactor. So I've been reading lots of 1980s articles on tech.
Very cool. What's the best piece of professional advice you've received?
I think that would have to be you have to ask for what you want.
How about the worst piece of professional advice you've received?
Go get a graduate degree. Which I did not do.
What's your favorite color?
Red.
If you could take us to one restaurant in your town, where would we go?
We would go to Yoko's Sushi, which is awesome. Mm.
What's your favorite board game?
I think it's called Small World. I haven't played it in a little while, but...
All right, last question. Hulu or Netflix?
Netflix.
So that's all the time we have for today. Thanks for joining the show.
Thanks for having me on. It was fun.
In case our listeners want to follow up with you, where can they find you online?
I am on Twitter and at Kristen J. Val. And then I started a Medium publication very recently, kind of around these topics around ethics and how tech affects society, with the same username, Kristen J. Val. Right now, it's just two of my own articles, but I'd love to have other contributors. So if you're interested, please get in touch.
Thanks again, Kristen. I really think this was a good conversation and definitely, hopefully, put some food for thought in our listeners' minds.
Awesome. Thanks.
Control Click is produced by Bright Umbrella, a web services agency obsessed with happy clients. Today's podcast would not be possible without the support of this episode's sponsor. Many thanks to Craft CMS.
We'd also like to thank our hosting partner, Argus Tech.
And thanks to our listeners for tuning in. If you want to know more about Control Click, make sure you follow us on Twitter at Control Clickcast or visit our website, controlclickcast.com. And if you like this episode, please give us a review on Stitcher or Apple Podcasts or both. Links are in our show notes and on our site.
Don't forget to tune in to our next episode when Laurie Voss joins the show to discuss the current state of web development trends. Be sure to check out controlclickcast.com/schedule for more upcoming topics.
This is Leia Alcantara
and Emily Lewis
signing off for Control Clickcast. See you next time.
Cheers.